So I'm going to do the talk tonight, and basically just to recap on what we've been looking at so far. We've been looking at stories and symbols in the Buddhist tradition, and we looked at the problem as demonstrated in stories, and we looked at the solution, the enlightenment of the Buddha, through symbols of stories. And at the moment we're looking at the path to freedom, and all the different kind of formulations and stories and symbols around basically the way to enlightenment. And we've started off looking at that kind of journey by looking at the three ways of looking at the path, the three ways of exploring what a path to freedom, what the path to enlightenment actually means. So basically we've been looking at, well, you've got this, at the moment what we're faced with is a discrepancy between us, A, and where we want to, who we want to become, where we want to go, which is B, or the Buddha. And in the first week, we looked at the myth of self-development, when A goes on a journey of striving and effort and becomes B through practicing, ethics and meditation and wisdom and changing yourself, basically, into B. And last week we looked at, actually, instead of A becoming B, we looked at B becoming A, of A just being receptive to B and opening up and allowing B to take them over as a way of becoming enlightened, becoming a Buddha. But this week we're going to look at the last myth, which is the myth of self-realization, which is another way of B to become A. It's another way of becoming the Buddha by allowing the Buddha to take over you. But instead of the Buddha coming from outside into you, it's this myth is about revealing the inner Buddha within. So it's not like B takes A over from the outside. It's almost like A is B and was always B. So it's allowing B to take you over from the inside. So so we've looked at the two myths of self-development and self-surrender, and now we're on to self-realization. So in self-realization, it's not a question of me becoming the Buddha, and it's not a question of the Buddha taking me over, because in a way those are quite dualistic concepts. It implies that I'm separate from the Buddha. In this myth of self-realization, it's not a question of the Buddha being different from me. All I have to do is realize that I always was the Buddha, that the Buddha is my own very nature. And it's not a question of a journey at all. It's just a question of realizing who I am in my deepest nature. So it's a bit like the first week we looked at all these models in the story of the Lotus Sutra, of the myth of the return journey. And in the story in the Lotus Sutra, there's a son who's estranged from his father at birth. And the father's a very rich man. But because the son is distanced from his father at birth, he doesn't really realise who he is. And he spends the first part of his life wandering amongst vagabonds and bums and picks up all sorts of bad habits. And through his years of wandering and poverty, well, he degrades himself. He becomes much more crude in nature than he would have if he had been brought up with a rich man as his son. And we looked at in the Lotus Sutra, well, there is a point where the son sees his father. And all he sees is this rich man up on his throne in his really nice house. And he's just standing there at the gate, this kind of tramp. You know, and he just looks at this rich man and just in awe and doesn't recognise his own father. But the father recognises the son. And the father undertakes a long plan to reconnect with his son and to reveal to the son his own nature, to acclimatise the son to his own real nature. So in a way, that's a bit about the myth of self-realisation. What it's saying is that we're all in the way, in the position of this son. We've all taken on all these really bad habits through years of wandering in samsara, through wandering in mundane life. But actually, all that's done is estrange us from our true nature. And it's our job in the spiritual life to just reacclimatise ourselves with who we really are. And the spiritual life is about uncovering our original nature. Our original nature is the inheritance of the best of, in the inheritor of the best of all beings. And that's who we are in our nature. And all we've got to do is rediscover that, acclimatise ourselves to that truth and act that truth out. So this myth of self-realisation is saying that Buddhahood was always your own deepest nature. That's who you are. And what you've got to do is wake up to that. So I'm going to illustrate this. That's sort of recapping on what we looked at before. But I'm going to illustrate this this myth in a, I would say it's a symbol, but it's more like a vision. It's more like a vision in Buddhism. And it's more like an image. So the image starts off with you as you usually are, right? Dead clumsy, unintegrated, full of conflict, sometimes full of rage, if you're like me, and with a mind very much like a monkey. So that's you as you ordinarily are. You, in all your faults, in all your glories, you're just sitting there, just you as you are. A bit of a mess, but kind of all right, you know. And somewhere in this kind of mad, in this mad life that you lead, there's a little seed of something. There's a little seed of something, and that seed is a recognition that all that you want is to be happy, and all that you want is to be free from suffering. And somehow there's a little seed of knowledge of that, but not only that you want to be free from suffering and you want to be happy, but so does everyone else. And within all the craziness of your life, within all that unskillful behaviour, within all that confusion, actually there's this kind of pearl of wisdom which just recognises another human being as being similar to yourself, and that loves them, and that wants them to be happy and well. There's a little recognition that we're all in the same boat. There's a little resonance from one human being to another, a little sense of connection. So what happens with that little sense of connection? Well, that little sense of the connection is something called metta. It's the metta bhavana that's like a shaft of light and beauty in a very, very mad world. And what happens in this vision is that that little seed of metta, that shaft of light, opens up like a ball of energy and brightness and beauty in your heart, and it gets brighter and brighter and brighter, and suddenly it's so bright that it just shines through all the confusion and all the greed and all the hatred and all the stupid things that we've done in our lives. It shines so brightly, so intensely, that it just blows all of that out of the picture, and a form starts to appear. So in this vision, that form is White Tara. And White Tara is made out of 1,000 autumn moons, shining, completely iridescent, completely beautiful, like a mother or a queen, like a young girl, full of light and playfulness. And Tara is surrounded by dancing moonbeams and dancing rainbows, and she's made out of light. And there's so much brightness and clarity and energy that there's places in her skin that just shine out with these eyes. So she's got like your eyes, but she's also got an eye right in the centre of her forehead. She's got eyes in the palms of her hands and in the soles of her feet. And it's not that she's just a bit deformed or something. It's actually, there's just so much clarity and wisdom that it's just shining out of her. She can't help but just to see all beings. And in this vision, that's you. You've taken the form of Tara. You're so bright and full of energy, you can just see everything as it is. So in this vision, and you can see everything, you can see in all directions, you just see the truth for what it is. And well, what do you see? In this vision, what you see is that you're surrounded by all beings of all three times. And that's the past, the present, and the future. And you see them crowded around you in a vast assembly. And your response to them, your resonance with them, your realization that they're in some way the same as you, that you're all inheritors of humanity, is so great that this shaft of light that started off in your heart just bursts out. And it bursts out and it says, you were never apart from me. You were never separate from me. We're all part of the same humanity. And the light bursts out from your heart and it goes in all directions. And then something amazing happens. Because in each human being, in each being in this vast assembly, this infinite number of beings, there's a resonance that they recognize you as a human being too. And in their heart, the light that's coming from you sort of shimmers off their heart too. And suddenly, they're all turned into white Tara too. The light from your heart goes out into everyone else's heart and turns them all into white Tara. And so suddenly you're seated in this vast assembly of white Taras. Everyone is white Tara. The people that you don't like, the people that have got on your nerves for centuries, the people that you do like, your best mates, your parents, your children, the lady at the bus stop with the pram, the bus driver, the people at the Buddhist centre, the people living in all those war zones, people on drugs, the people who are just working in their offices, all beings, every single being is transformed from the light at your heart centre into white Tara. And because they're white Tara, their hearts explode with joy too. So you know, it's not just you sending out light, transforming all beings into white Tara. They're also sending out light, transforming each other and transforming you. And all there is then is this kind of blaze of light and people seated in their truest, deepest nature, that they're all white Tara. So, yeah, I didn't just make that vision up. That vision is part of the white Tara visualization practice that I took up at ordination. It's one very small part. It's quite a big visualization practice. But in a way, that vision embodies what this myth of self-realization is all about. It's about seeing all beings as the Buddha and seeing yourself as the Buddha too. Seeing that all beings in their deepest, truest nature are all white Tara, or they're all the Buddha, or they're all enlightened. That in our deepest potentials, that's who we really are. And in doing that visualization, what happens is you start to relate to each other on that basis. You start to relate to others as if you're seeing them as white Tara. You know, it's all a bit weird if they're a man or something, but underneath there's that little reflection of that. Well, that's who they are in their deepest nature. So in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, which goes into a lot about this myth, the Buddha says in it, he says, when I regard all beings with my Buddha eye, I see that hidden within the greed, desire, anger and stupidity, there is seated, noble and unmoving, the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's vision and the Buddha's body. All beings, though they find themselves with all sorts of faults, have a seed of Buddhahood that is eternally unsullied and that is replete with virtues no different from my own. Moreover, it is just like a person with supernatural vision who can see the bodies of Buddhas seated in lotus position inside the flowers. And even though the petals are not, yet unfurled, after the wilted petals have been removed, those Buddhas are manifested for all to see. The Buddha can really see the seed of Buddhahood in all beings. And because he wants to disclose their Buddha nature to them, he expounds the sutras and the Dharma in order to destroy obstacles and reveal the Buddha nature. So this myth is a vision. It's a vision of all beings as perfect Buddhas. But the only snag is you're all inside these lotus flowers. And beautiful though these lotus flowers are, well, some of them, you know, it's a bit like having a vase of flowers. Some of them are a bit on the smelly side, slightly rotting, decaying side. But some of them are really beautiful. some bits, you know, there's a bit of both in each flower maybe. And the job of the Buddha is to open out that flower, get rid of the petals and reveal the Buddha within. And that's the job of the spiritual life, and it's the job of the Dharma and the Buddha's teaching. So, well, what does this vision mean? The first thing to say when you're talking about this vision of self-realization is that it's not describing some sort of metaphysical truth. It's not saying that we have an actual existence as a Buddha. So it's quite clear to me that although this sounds really great, actually from where I'm standing right here and now, I'm not actually enlightened. I'm really sorry about that. I wish I was, but you know, I'm just not. It's not saying this is the actual state of affairs, you know, somehow if we got a kind of chisel and kind of scrubbed off the surface of everyone, there'd be this kind of shining Buddha within. It's not saying that. It's not meant to be taken literally. It's not meant to be taken as a whole system of logical, rational thought. Because logically with it, there are all sorts of problems. Well, there's this problem that if I'm the Buddha, and I always was the Buddha, well, why don't I behave like one? Why am I so full of confusion? Why am I so full of greed and hatred? So, you know, if we're all Buddhas, why are we behaving so idiotically and why are we suffering so much? So you're not meant to be taking this literally. It's not an actual kind of philosophical doctrine about who we really are. It's a vision. It's a myth that's meant to inspire and galvanize you. It's a view to shape the world. So when I say it's a myth, it doesn't mean that it's just out there with the fairies. It's actually a view. It's a view that enables you to operate in the world and enables you to relate to other beings in a particular way. It's a vision of yourself. And more importantly than being a vision of yourself, I think it's a vision of other beings. So, yeah, it's a poetic truth. And there are poetic truths. Poetic truth doesn't mean unreal. It just means that it's a higher kind of vision rather than an intellectual or logical truth. So, well, if we really believed this, if we really took this on as a view to galvanize our lives or to shape our lives, we really took this on as a vision, well, what effect would it have on us? And I think the first thing is, it's a vision of other people. So if we were to relate to other people as if they were Buddhas, just hidden within this kind of lotus flower, what would we treat them like? How would we treat those beings? Well, in a way, if we saw each other all as kind of enlightened beings, then all we want to do is to treat each other with respect, trying to encourage each other, trying to bring out our better nature. We'd always be about trying to build other people's confidence and trying to bring them on. We'd always be about affirming other beings and wanting them to do the best for themselves. And that's how we'd relate to each other. We'd relate to each other from the best in ourselves. And it's a bit of a cliche, but it is true, that if you relate to the best in another person, it means that they start acting out their best. If you relate to them as if they're just, you know, like a kind of spiritual worm or something, then they're just going to act that out. If you treat them like they're completely mundane and full of greed, hatred and delusion, well, that's what they're going to act out. But if you treat people as if they're something incredibly beautiful, but it just needs to be revealed, it just needs to be brought out and encouraged, well, what will happen is that that nature, that truly beautiful nature, will be encouraged and it will come out. So, you know, okay, so there's this vision of others where, in a way, your job in life is to try and encourage them, to try and bring out their better nature. But it might be that actually some people's Buddha nature are quite hard to see, and they're not acting out from their Buddhist, from their better nature. So it's not like you're going to be a complete pushover and treat everyone as if they're already enlightened, because in a way they're not. Their Buddha nature might be a bit obscured. But what you try and do is always try and relate to the best in them, to the best as far as you can see it. try and encourage them, try and help them to act positively, try and help them to act ethically, encourage their meditation practice, encourage them to be an individual and to explore their interests and to grow and to develop as a human being. So whatever stage they're at in that process, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to bring out their better nature. So in that quote from the Tathagatagarbha, the Buddha says, well, because he wants to disclose their Buddha nature to them, he expounds the sutra and the Dharma in order to destroy obstacles and reveal the Buddha nature. So it's also saying, well, that's the point of the Dharma. The point of the Dharma is not to just impose loads of doctrines on people, but it's trying to say, hey, look, this is who you really are. You know, all you need to do is act in line with who you really are. And all it's doing is it's like you can see the good in someone. You can really, really see their beauty and their wisdom and their compassion. And it's just a little under the surface. And if you could just bring it out, if you could just encourage people, then there they'd be. They'd just shine in their own nature, their own beautiful, shining Buddha nature. So, yeah, so it's incredibly kind vision of other beings. And it's incredibly affirming, actually. In a way, it's your job in life to affirm and to bring other people on. And it also means that you can't be superior to anyone else, because we've all got the same Buddha nature. No one person has got more Buddha nature than another person. Actually, we're all in the same boat. And just as I help you reveal your Buddha nature, you have to help me reveal mine. So that's where this vision comes in, that when White Tara, transforms all beings into White Tara, well, then they send out their light to you as well. The light goes in all directions. It's not just you transforming beings into White Tara, but they transform you into White Tara as well. So in a way, I really like this model. I think this model, at the moment anyway, I find this the most kind of moving and the most inspiring to positive action, because it's such a positive and inspiring vision of humanity, and it's such an important way to relate to others, a vision of how to relate to others. But it's also a vision of how to relate to yourself. So just as if you really believe that everyone has got this shining Buddha nature, just obscured from the moment, just as you believe that of other people, you also believe it of yourself, and you want to relate to the best in yourself. So it's a bit like, in our normal life, what we do is we let this kind of mundane being take control, you know, the confused being. The being that doesn't really know what's going on, the being that likes to speculate and, have loads of weird ideas about things. We let that being take control, and in a way our lower selves take control. But the more we get this kind of vision of humanity that occurs in the self-realization kind of doctrines, then the more we let the best in ourselves take control, the more we decide, well, actually, the person I'm going to let can take control of my life is this Buddha within. So instead of letting the mundane being, the lower self, make the decisions in your life, you start to think, well, what would Tara say? You know, me as Tara, what would the best in myself be, say, and do? And your life becomes about revealing and acting from the best in yourself, just as you try and relate to the best in others. You try and relate to the best in yourself. Because I think what the problem is about the spiritual life is that if we see it too much in terms of a linear path, if we see it too much of, here I am and here the Buddha is, then the Buddha is always just a little bit further away. Sometimes he's a lot further away, and sometimes he's just a little bit over the brow of the hill, you know. And then you can always give yourself an excuse. You can always say, well, yeah, well, maybe tomorrow. Maybe when I manage to get on retreat. Or maybe when I manage to get on the urban retreat. Or, you know, maybe when the kids are grown up. Then I'll start to really practice the spiritual life. And maybe when I've retired, you know, then I can really practice spiritual life. And maybe when I'm living as a hermit in the Himalayas. with some really groovy Tibetan master. Yeah, then I'm going to really practice, actually. But I think I'll wait till I get to India, at least, you know. Or you might think to yourself, well, yeah, maybe it's kind of for other people and, like, you know, people like Amoghavaksa. He can do all the spiritual thing, but I'm not really that a spiritual person. I mean, you know, I'm never really going to get there. I might sort of hover about a bit, sort of hover around A, up and down like this. But actually, it's just a little bit far away. I mean, you know, the Buddha is all right, but it's not really me, actually. He's sort of, you know, Indian and dead and all sorts of things. But I don't really think of me. I mean, I couldn't do that. You know, maybe next lifetime. Oh, yeah, okay. But actually, well, you're completely mistaken, because Buddhahood is about seeing reality. And reality isn't just round the corner. Reality is right here. It's right now. If we could only just wake up to it, it's all around us. It's in those 199 fleece blankets. It's in all these cushions that we managed to find from somewhere. It's all in all these the mats that we sewed. It's in, you know, my jeans from Primark. It's in all those mundane and ridiculous things. There is reality. They are all part of reality. It's not around the corner. It's not in a cave in the Himalayas. And every time you waste those, every moment that you think, well, you know, maybe tomorrow, maybe when I get round to meditating or whatever, is time wasted away from who you really are. It's even more separation from your own nature. So what I want you to think is, any time you get the thought, well, I'll live this spiritual life when I go on retreat or whenever it is, you know, or when I get time to meditate or when my kids are grown up, I am going to personally take it on to turn into an imp and come into your house. And what I'm going to do is, I'm going to stand right next to you and I'm going to go, no, no, no. Sorry about that. Which could be slightly embarrassing, you know, if you're with your boss in a business lunch. So I'm warning you now that that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to transform into an imp and I'm going to go in your houses and I'm going to say now. So, come back from that. So what I think this whole myth is trying to demonstrate to you is something called longing faith. So in Buddhism, Shraddha, or faith, what we would translate as faith, has three aspects. There's understanding faith, when you really know something to be true. You really get a kind of real deeply felt sense. Oh yeah, that is right. I really understand that. And there's what's sometimes called admiring Shraddha, which is the aspect of faith where you really emotionally know something. When all your experience tells you, oh yeah, that's it. And when, you know, you'll really feel emotionally connected to it. That's kind of who you want to be. But there's also this other aspect of faith, which is called longing faith. And it's the kind of faith which knows what's possible, that knows in its heart of hearts, you know, in your heart of hearts, what's truly possible. And you long for it. And self-realization is, and that vision of humanity and vision of yourself is kind of trying to appeal to that part of yourself that longs for your own true nature, that longs for what's possible. Because I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm really tired, actually. I feel like I've been just wandering through existence. Like, I'm not actually that old, but ever since I was born, I've always felt that I've just... really tired, and I'm really tired of living out these ridiculous, age-old, stupid, habitual tendencies, and I'm tired of suffering, and I'm tired of having unrealistic expectations of the world, and I hear the Dharma, but I don't listen, and I get into the same old patterns and the same old traps again and again and again and again, and I'm tired, and all I want to be is reunited with who I really am. All I want to be is liberated, and I long for it. I've got this vision, you know, of who I could be, and I just long for it. I long for what is possible, and I long to be reunited with who I really am. And that's what longing Shraddha is. It's an urgency, it's a deep heartfelt sense that I could be more, that actually that I could be the Buddha, that I'm capable of limitless wisdom and limitless compassion, just as the Buddha is. And until I really experience that, until I'm really at one with my own deepest nature, then I'm always going to feel just tired, and as if something in my life could just be a lot better, and it isn't. So it's that kind of longing. It's a longing for what is possible. It's a longing to just be united with who you really are, and to just let go of these old games, old petty concerns, and ridiculous things that you do in your life. And just to be reunited with who you really are. And who you really are is, in a way, it's the Buddha. So it's a vision of other people. And it's also a vision of yourself and who you really are. And it ties in with this longing Shraddha, or longing faith. But it's a bit more than that as well. It's also an experience. It's if you read stories about people becoming enlightened, it seems that when people become enlightened, quite often what they find is it's incredibly funny, which is a bit odd. And you get all these stories about Zen masters who sort of get enlightened on the toilet. They often get enlightened on the toilet. Or maybe it was just once, but it really stuck in my head anyway. Someone definitely gets enlightened on the toilet. Anyway, they're sitting there, and all they can do is laugh. So they just have hysterics. It's really, really funny. And why it's funny is because actually when you get enlightened, you realise that all the time you were striving for a different experience. It was a bit like, you know, I'm trying to get into this realm called enlightenment, and it's this faraway land. You have to go up these mountains and, you know, it's all really difficult and make loads of effort to get into this sort of different realm and this different way of seeing things. And when you get there, all you realise is that it was there all along. That actually you're not getting anywhere different. And that's who you were all along. You were just never awake to it. So this vision of self-realisation is also an experience. It's an experience of what? It's a bit like this. It's a bit like this when you get enlightened. That actually you realise you were never separate from enlightenment. And that enlightenment is in a different realm. So sometimes it's described as, there's a text where it's described as like being reunited with a long-lost friend. It's like, oh yeah, you're just finding out something you knew all along. You were just never quite awake to it. Or it's like finding that you had a jewel sewn into your coat or into your robe. It was like you spent all this time being poor and miserable and wondering when you were going to get where you were going to get your next meal from. And then you realised that, oh yeah, oh, I've just got this priceless jewel in my coat. I had it all along. And it's that kind of experience. Getting enlightened is that kind of experience. You realise that, oh yeah, how ridiculous to think I was separate from it. And it's incredibly funny. You realise what a complete plonker you've been all these years. So that's why as well, I'm not going to go into it, but for some of you who know the Vajrasattva mantra, there's a laugh in the middle. It's a bit weird, and we all kind of ritually do this thing where we go, ha 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 ho, really miserably. And really kind of intently, yes, because that's the part of the 100-syllable Vajrasattva mantra, you know. Well, it is actually a laugh. It's not meant to be like, you know, Father Christmas or something, or some song words. It's actually a laugh. Because it's so incredibly funny that you thought that you were separate from your enlightenment, and there you are, you know, hiking up the mountain, and all you had to do was sit at home. So it's an experience as well as a vision of yourself and others. But in a way, well, you might get a sense of some of the dangers of this as well. So it's not a complete vision in itself. It's just sort of one angle of looking at your spiritual journey. It's a poetic way of looking at your spiritual journey. And it's a very positive way of looking at your spiritual journey. It leads to an incredible sense of kindness and affirmation, particularly of others. And it's got this kind of cosmic perspective that really galvanises you and inspires you into action. But you can't take it too literally. And I haven't really read about this, but I did hear that there was a group of people that took it too literally, and they were some of the Zen schools in Japan. And what they thought is, well, if I'm a Buddha from the very beginning, and I'm at one with my enlightened state, then I don't need to follow the kind of, you know, all those really boring rules in the Pali Canon and at the time of the Buddha. I don't need to follow them because I'm already a Buddha, I'm already liberated. So it doesn't really matter what I do. So what happened was, this led to quite a religious justification for the Japanese atrocities in World War II. So, you know, it's a pretty extreme danger. It's basically saying, I'm a Buddha from beginningless time, so I can torture people. Which I wouldn't recommend taking it that literally, you know. It does have very serious consequences. So, yeah, okay. Your deepest nature is that you are a Buddha. But you don't dispense with your ethical rules. You don't dispense with the path, and the path of self-development particularly. So Padmasambhava, and I might not be quoting him word for word, but he says something like, though my view may be as vast as the sky, my conduct is as fine as grain of flour. So though my view may be as vast as the sky, my conduct is as fine as grains of flour. So, okay, yeah, you've got this great big cosmic vision, and that's brilliant. But don't forget that that cosmic vision is only realised by those little actions. And yes, it is important to do the washing up. And yes, it is important to say hello to people when they say hello to you. And it is important to make people cups of tea. All those things are important because they're all your tiny movements of ethical conduct. So, yeah. To become your own Buddha nature, you have to start acting it out. You have to start revealing it. It's like you have to take off the dead leaves and the dead petals off this flower to reveal the Buddha within. It's not just standing there, you know. And you can get this. You don't get it at this Buddhist centre, but I know when I go to parties with my parents, the words that I always dread are, oh yeah, there's another Buddhist here. And then they go and get me to sit next to the other Buddhist. And the other Buddhist ends up saying something to me like, yeah, well, you know, I don't need to meditate. I mean, life is just meditation. And as they're piling a big hunk of dead cow onto their plate, they start going, yeah, because I'm already the Buddha, you know. I mean, you know, it's just who we are, you know. I am the Buddha. Just let it come out, man. And I just think, well, you don't look very much like the Buddha to me. I think I'd rather sit next to the alcoholic who stares at my cleavage, quite frankly. So, yeah, so it does happen, this kind of this awful Buddhist complacency of, yeah, well, it's all right, just relax. Vajratara, just relax, because we're all the Buddha. We're all, you know, you're Tara, and, you know, that's really groovy. So, yeah. So Sangharakshana makes quite an interesting point, actually. Probably not in the same way that I've just made it, but, you know, more sensible way. Is that, take this vision to really inspire you. Take this vision to really inspire you in your own journey and in your way of relating to other people. Take it as a myth to inspire and galvanise you. But if you're looking for how to act in your everyday life, what you need is you need the Pali Canon, which means that you need the original words of the Buddha and all those kind of really helpful advice the Buddha had for how to live an ordinary life, which is as relevant today as it was 2,500 years ago. You know, how to be a friend, how to make efforts. You know, his last words were reportedly, with mindfulness, strive on. So, you know, all those things are how to lead your life, how to make your conduct as fine as grain of flowers. Flowers? Flower. So keep the vision, but also keep the conduct. And there's another point as well, which is that in this myth of self-realization, your deepest nature is the Buddha, but it's not a question of you possessing Buddha nature. It's not like saying, hey, my name's Vajratara and I'm the Buddha. My deepest nature is this kind of Buddha called Vajratara, and it kind of looks like me, and it's as groovy as me, and, you know, has the same taste, and great clothes, style, and all the rest of it. So your Buddha nature is not about you. It's not a kind of, it's not a nature that you can possess, like your personality or something like that. You can't possess Buddha nature as an individual entity. What happens is when you reveal your Buddha nature, you realize that your Buddha nature is transpersonal. It's a bit of a weird vision, this, actually. That it's like in this image of the White Tara visualization practice. Actually, you realize that you all share in the same Buddha nature. Not that the Buddha nature is completely individual to each human being, but you're all sharing in a greater vision of humanity. You're all sharing in the same enlightenment. So it's not about me becoming my Buddha nature. It's about me taking part in the greater Buddha nature. So it's a bit of a weird idea, but you see, it's quite hard to talk about it because you're in this vision, and in the ultimate realization of the vision, you go beyond self and other. So it's not about your Buddha nature realizing my Buddha nature, like my personality. It's about realizing something much bigger than you. It's about realizing a greater, better nature that we're all connected to. So Karmala Shila went on this, who's someone who does a lot of meditation in the movement. That'll do. He wrote a book as well about meditation, which is very good. But he went on this really, really long solitary. And he said one of the things that he realised in this long solitary was that actually, you know, we go on about interconnectedness a lot in the Buddhist centre and everything. We go on about interconnectedness a lot. But if you really think about it, well, what it means as well is that if everything is interconnected, you're also interconnected with the best of all beings. You're also interconnected with the Buddha. And the Buddha is part of you. So revealing your Buddha nature is not about revealing a personal Buddha nature or possessing, I possess my Buddha nature. It's more like you realize that you're connected with the best of all beings. You're living out your connectedness with the best of all beings. Just as you're part of everything, so you're part of the best. And in living out your Buddha nature, you're just connecting up with your inheritance, which is the same as everyone else's inheritance. It's not just yours as an individual. So what we get into here is we get into the territory of self-surrender. That at some point you have to realize that your Buddha nature is about opening up to something that's much bigger than your present level of experience. It's about opening up to something much bigger than you. And that's what you have to do to get enlightened. You have to open up to something that's beyond you as a separate individual. And it all sounds a bit odd because we start to sort of blur the distinction between self and other. And that's, you can't really do that linguistically. So the myth of self-realization also has to include self-development. You also need to work on your ethical conduct to reveal your Buddha nature. But you also have to realize that your Buddha nature is transpersonal, and it's about opening up to something that's much bigger than you. So hopefully, well, we've got a good idea of what all these models, you know, that there are different ways of looking at the path. And one mustn't think of the path as like the Buddha about 100 miles away and I'm here and I might as well not bother. Might as well just sit down and have a picnic. But also, we're sort of getting a sense that all of these myths about the path include each other and have echoes of each other in them, and that we need all three in some way. So the journey, the myth of the journey, coming back to the myth of the journey, and the myth of the path, well, we need development. We need to put one foot in front of the other. We need what Sangharakshita calls the path of regular steps. But we also need receptivity to a larger experience, to an experience that might be beyond our current level of understanding, beyond our current mental state. And we've also got to realise that it's not a journey to a new place. It's not like we're going to go to the realm of the Buddhas, like, you know, some kind of heavenly realm or something. Actually, we've got to realise that the journey is just deeper and deeper and deeper into what we already know, into this reality here and now. So the journey, in a way, is just about discovering the truth. It's not about going anywhere. It's discovering the truth of who you are here and now, and who others are as well. And that actually, when you realise that, it's all a big joke. It's just incredibly funny, for some bizarre reason.